Goulet. You're listening to Harbinger Showcase. Harbinger Showcase is a weekly podcast syndicated to community and campus radio, including CITR, CJSR, and Co-op Radio in Vancouver, Victoria's CFUV, CIVL in Abbotsford, CKUW and CJUM in Winnipeg, at Met Radio in Toronto, at Radio Laurier in Waterloo, at CFMU in Hamilton, at CJM in Windsor, at Montreal CKUT, and at CJBU in Sydney, Nova Scotia. I'm featuring highlights from the country's favorite progressive podcast community. Since launching in 2020, the Harbinger Media Network's become Canada's number one listener-supported nonprofit podcast network, featuring 83 shows exploring politics, society, and culture from progressive perspective. Find out more about the community and subscribe to our weekly newsletter at harbingermedianetwork.com. On this episode, we discuss the dismissal of a federal government lawyer for calling for divestment from Israel on Palestine debrief, explain why the federal government's Bill C-9 legislation to combat hate crimes is a threat to civil liberties on Red Eye, and explore the history of the 19th century Montreal journalist, politician, and union leader, Mireille Langteau, Canada's first social democrat, on the Broadbent Institute's perspectives. But first, this episode of Harbinger Showcase is brought to you by Canada's progressive journalism community, Unrigged. Launched in 2023 as a response to Meta's Canadian news ban, Unrigged.ca is a one-stop website aggregating and updating new journalism on the hour, including podcasts, videos, newsletters, and in-depth reporting from publishers like Briar Patch in Regina, The Grind in Toronto, The Independent in St. John's, and national publications like Press Progress, The Breach, The Maple, and 24 more. Bookmark the site and make it your daily destination for Canadian news at unrigged.ca. And this episode of Harbinger Showcase is also brought to you by the Alberta Advantage Podcast. Based in Calgary, this collective of more than 20 activists, academics, and journalists have been broadcasting award-winning political commentary, news, and analysis since 2017. On this excerpt from a new episode, the team opens the Canadian trench coat to reveal corporate impunity in a conversation discussing how the state facilitates mining and resource extraction domestically and globally at the expense of the common good. Now, here's the show.
Like, any victory for responsible mining interests is a victory for Canadian investors, said the counselor for the Canadian embassy. Makes no
difference where the Alberta Advantage is a proud member of the Harbinger Media Network. This independent, listener-supported podcast is possible thanks to listeners like you. If you think what we do is important, support us with a monthly donation at patreon.com/albertaadvantage.
And welcome to the Alberta Advantage. I'm your host, Kate Jacobson, and joining Team Advantage today, we have Joel.
Hello, hello.
And Patrick.
Hi there.
And me, Dave. Hey, if you are a regular listener to the podcast, you are probably wondering why you're hearing some voices you haven't heard in a while. That is because this episode was recorded in 2021 and has been sitting in the vault since then. Anyways, I'm going to be jumping in and out at a couple places here just to update things as some things have changed since 2021.
Here on the podcast and on online, we like to joke around and say that Canada is a fake country, that it's actually just several resource extraction companies wearing a trench coat. And today, our podcast episode is going to be about peeling back that maple leaf trench coat and discussing something that has both Canadian and international dimensions, the mining industry. Before we get into it too much, I do think it's worth thinking a bit about how we think about mining and its relationships to the rest of the social and economic systems that it interacts with. And this is because often when we think of a mine, we think of a hole in the ground, a particular geographic site where a resource has been extracted. And it's very normal in this imaginary of sorts to think a mine stops exactly where that hole in the ground is. And you might, you know, maybe you're thinking, oh, there's a company town next door, or a resource frontier that's immediately proximate to the mine creates a culture of like rip and ship, get your money and get out. But what we want to do in this episode is think about mining in a much, much broader sense. And we'll be drawing primarily from two texts. This is Martin Arboleda's Planetary Mine and Alain Danault's and William Sachet's Imperial Canada Inc. And this is because a mine isn't just the site where resource extraction happens, the aforementioned hole in the ground. It's part of a whole network. of things. So, you know, laborers that work in a mine are part of a whole labor market and are probably also part of an immigration regime that supplies the labor market with laborers to keep wages from climbing higher. A mine is also part of a global supply chain of machines and parts that facilitate the mining process and also transport mined materials to processing and refinement and export to other parts of the supply chain. A mine is usually also a very capital-intensive site. So this is a place where huge financial interests and institutional investors have anchored their financial investments into the ground in a somewhat literal sense, in the shape of fixed capital. And the machines and the structures and the infrastructure that make up this mine are fixed capital. And lastly, before we get into the episode, mines don't just make a hole in the ground. They make other places too. And I think a really obvious example that's in our own backyard is that the open pit mines that extract bitumen from the Athabasca tar sands in northern Alberta don't just simply make those holes in the ground. And they also don't even simply make a town like Fort McMurray. They also make, you know, and basically just like in addition to these sort of enormous projects taking place in northern Alberta, the big multinational companies that organize and administer and finance these projects also make the corporate office towers of Calgary and their workforce, both in northern Alberta and in corporate Calgary, who then help make Calgary suburbs. And to keep it the idea, you know, one could also argue that the mines also create dispossession and environmental pollution. They make the high incidences of cancer in Fort Chipewyan in Alberta's north, for example.
Talking about mining in Canada is really interesting because on the one hand, it's not like a common thing to think about. Like, people don't walk down the street and talk to you about mining necessarily. But on the other hand, mining makes up a huge, enormous part of Canada's history. Like, Canada's history is like filled with basically various resource extraction schemes. But in particular, mining usually has some sort of history in every territory or province in the country. You could go across the country from British Columbia tons of mining struggle there. Alberta, obviously, like coal mining history during their railway age and on. And in addition to the extraction of the tar sands or oil sands in Alberta's north, which is also a type of mining, in Saskatchewan, you've got mining for potash, for example. And you've also got like uranium mining and stuff like that that happened in Saskatchewan. There's also the whole Canadian Shield. All kinds of metals have been mined there, in addition to diamonds and precious metals and minerals of all kinds. You know, you could go basically in every territory in the country and find different kinds of mining projects that have occurred. It's had a huge impact on Canadian society, and often that doesn't get really acknowledged. In a way, Canada has been this kind of lab for doing mining or perfecting the craft of mining. And mining has been so central to the project of making a Canadian state that we kind of have to ask ourselves if Canada has ever really been a nation-building project, or if it's been like a mining project with a kind of veneer of nation building on top of it as a kind of PR exercise to make sure the mining can continue to happen.
And so, you know, with that bit of like, you know, theorizing out of the way, let's talk a little more specifically about Canada and mining companies, right? So as of 2013, 75% of the world's publicly listed mining companies were headquartered in Canada. Bay Street and the Toronto Stock Exchange supply more than one-third of the world's total equity finance for the mining industry. Toronto provides extractive industries with, you know, some really substantial benefits. For example, the TSX makes it easy for investors to speculate. Federal and provincial tax incentives encourage investors to put their money in mining companies. And Canada has little to no history of going after Canadian registered corporations accused of abuse or even crime outside of Canadian borders. And so Canada's soft and careful handling of things like the SNC-Lavalin affair in 2019 ended up being a scandal because the prime minister literally advocated too hard to protect SNC-Lavalin. Canada's legal system allows threats to reputation to take precedence over the right of freedom of speech. So saying something negative about a specific mining company might get you into a ton of legal trouble. Like, well, the laws protecting your right to say those negative things might be quite weak. And Canada's mining industry enjoys a range of benefits and active assistance from the Canadian state. The Canadian International Development Agency, or CETA, for example, had programs that pairs funding for NGOs with mining companies, which is wow.
It's called Synergy.
Yeah, no kidding. Basically helping them do public relations and corporate social responsibility abroad. Export Development Canada also provided insurance to extractive industry based in Canada. And political risks are one of the things they insure against. So the Canadian state has a direct interest in minimizing, quote, risks and making sure that these companies remain profitable. So in 2013, got folded into a new hybrid department now called the Department of Foreign Affairs, Trade and Development.
The role of finance here is really worth thinking through. Let's say completely hypothetically, a mining company abroad is doing some awful stuff. Completely hypothetically, this has never happened in real life, to my knowledge. but going into territory without consent of the indigenous population, labor practices that put workers in danger, environmental damage, all this kind of stuff. And maybe people start to notice this looks bad. But on the other side of the equation, you have a bunch of investors who've been taking advantage of low taxes and all kinds of incentives to sink their money into this same mining company. You also have the Canadian state that probably helps set up the whole situation as a foreign development scheme, maybe getting an NGO on board to partner with the mining company to make it look good. And so the Canadian state is in a position here where they look bad if they don't do anything, but really everything has been set up to incentivize the mining company to keep things going as they are. So this is the crux of the kind of big question we often ask ourselves when hypothetically this kind of situation might arise. Why won't politicians or the government do the right thing here? Clearly you have a mining company that might be doing really awful things. It should be simple to stop it, especially if it's headquartered in Canada. But the Canadian state does not want to send the wrong signal to investors, because investors in other mining companies might start to see the value of their investment drop and might even pull their investment. Canadian pension funds invest in mining companies, like teachers' pension funds and all this kind of stuff. So the value of a retiree's pension could take a hit if the Canadian state does anything that might affect this profitability. And then there could be electoral consequences to that as well.
And what happens here is really this process of colonialism, both at home and abroad, so to speak. And what I mean by that is that these methods that get perfected within Canada to facilitate mining companies and their operations end up being exported to the global south in this sort of perverse vertical integration by the same companies that do mining in Canada. So, for example, Canada's mining codes, which are basically the package of rules and regulations that ensure little to no taxes, the full socialization of the costs associated with mining, disregard for customary and indigenous rights, contempt for environmental issues, little regulatory oversight. All of these were put into place first in Ontario and in Quebec. They were then put into place as mining investment policy for the global south in countries like Colombia, Botswana, Zimbabwe, Guinea, and Zambia. And just like Canada doesn't do a great job, understatement of the century, of recognizing the rights of First Nations and their territories within Canada, particularly when it comes to the issue of resource extraction, this same model is used by mining companies abroad. And basically what happens is it becomes the problem, so to speak, of local authorities in the global south to navigate or deal with these claims, while mining corporations are basically doing what they've been designed to do, which is to make their profits. So, you know, I do really think there's something here where it's like, if you're fighting against a resource extraction project, it doesn't matter whether you're in Wet'suwet'en or Central America, you're going to have the repressive state apparatus that is going to be turned against you originates from literally the same people, from the same companies, from the same material and structural forces in our society. It is both imperialism at home within Canada's borders, and it is both imperialism abroad outside of Canada's borders. And I think an important theoretical framework to consider here, and we borrow this from Shipley and the book he wrote, Canada in the World, is this idea that the first act of foreign policy in Canada is encounters with Indigenous nations. And I think that is a really important lens to keep in mind when you're thinking about mining, because it can be very tempting to look at these things taking place within Canada's borders, particularly in opposition to resource extraction projects, and see them somehow as an aberration from like a Canadian way of doing things, or as an aberration from our rule of law, as an aberration from the way things are, rather than as one consistent part of a political project, which is this is the government of Canada's foreign policy with Indigenous people who do not consent to resource extraction, whether it's within Canada's borders or outside of Canada's borders with Canadian mining companies instead of the government.
Yeah. And so like the frustrating point that we're trying to draw out here is that like the sense of a failed nation building or even abortive nation building project in this country is entirely tied up with exporting that project all over the world in order to sort of take the Canadian system's kind of perfection of strip mining this country for the wealth of the capitalist class and imposing it upon everywhere else in the world.
And that's why they say the world needs more Canada.
That is not why they say that.
Was the Alberta Advantage. Find out more about the show at albertaadvantagepod.com and hear the rest of the conversation at harbingermedianetwork.com. You're listening to Harbinger Showcase on your local campus and community radio station. I'm Harbinger director Andre Goulet in Montreal. Coming up next. The production of Canadians for Justice and Peace in the Middle East, Palestine to Brief, is a podcast discussing stories, people, issues, and events related to Palestine in a series of interviews with experts, politicians, artists, and activists. On this excerpt from a new episode, federal government international law expert Paul Fauteau explains how his position as sport mediator wasn't renewed, citing, quote, lack of impartiality for sending two open letters to the Caisse de dépôt et placement du Québec, urging them to divest from Israel. Here's a highlight from that conversation.
In this episode of Palestine Debrief, I speak with Paul Fauteau, a lawyer and an advocate specializing in international law. Paul is also a former diplomat and has served as Director General in several federal departments, including Environment Canada and Indigenous and Northern Affairs. Paul shares a bizarre and rather troubling incident that he has recently experienced. His position as a sports mediator was not renewed, citing lack of impartiality for sending the CDPQ two open letters urging them to divest from Israel. Here's Paul sharing what happened and reflecting on his experience.
And so when I came back, I decided that I had been a passive ally of the Palestinian cause for long enough, and it was time to get active. So I hooked up with Karen Rodman of Just Peace Advocates, and it was Karen who brought to my attention the fact that the Caisse de dépôt et placement du Québec, which manages public Quebec pension plans, which is in fact the largest, second largest pension plan manager in Canada, had $14 billion worth of investments in companies that operated in the illegal Israeli settlements. Now, the illegal Israeli settlements are not just illegal in the West Bank. They are war crimes. They are prohibited by the 1949 Geneva Convention on the Protection of Civilians in Times of War. So I thought this was shocking, and that's where I decided to channel my efforts. And I initially wrote a letter calling on the CDPQ to respect international law and to cease to be complicit with Israeli war crimes by investing in companies that were complicit with the Israeli war crime constituted by the illegal Israeli settlements. And so my friend George, who is my professor of international law, as I mentioned, signed on, as did a number of other very highly respected lawyers from around the world. At that time, this was in November of 23, so in the months following the Hamas attacks on the southern Israel communities, no Quebec international lawyers wanted to sign on. This was way too touchy, and we can't take sides between belligerents. So I was the only Quebec lawyer, along with my international friends, to call on the CDPQ to end its complicity with Israeli war crimes. So that's how it started.
During that all this time you were employed as a sports mediator. That's I think also an interesting element.
Yes, that's another aspect of the story. So I became employed as a sports mediator in 2021. Yes, so after 30 years in government, the first 20 with Foreign Affairs, and then heading the Climate Change Bureau and Environment Canada, and subsequently the Reserve Lands Directorate in Indian Affairs, retired from government and began a new career as a mediator. And after a number of years practicing mediation, I got a gig as a sports mediator with a federally created and funded independent organization called the Center for Sport Dispute Resolution of Canada. So after the first 4 years, my mandate was coming to an end, and there was a call to express interest in renewing my mandate. So I wrote another nice letter saying, hey, this is what I've been doing for you over the last 4 years. In addition to my 4 years of experience as a sports mediator, I had all these qualifications to be hired by the SDRC as an arbitrator in sports matters as well. So I put in my bid to be renewed as a mediator and to get a new mandate as an arbitrator. So a few months later, I get the form letter saying, oh, sorry, we got many great candidacies and you were not successful. So I was really surprised. So I called up the DG and said, could I have a bit of feedback? You know, what happened? Why did the selection committee decide not to retain my candidacy? And she was very candid. And she said, well, look, they thought your performance over the last 4 years was perfect, you know, beyond reproach. All the feedback was great. But they did an internet search and they saw that you wrote not one, but two letters, because after the November 23 letter I mentioned, the CDPQ CEO, Charles Lemont, appeared before the Public Finance Committee of the National Assembly of Quebec, because the CDPQ has one shareholder, right? It's the government of Quebec. So every year he has to go and basically explain himself and respond to questions from members of the National Assembly. And he got some questions on these investments in the illegal Israeli settlements in the occupied Palestine territory. And he gave a whole bunch of bullshit excuses. So I wrote a reply and got my six world-renowned experts in public international law to say why his excuses did not hold water legally and maintaining the call we had issued in November 2023 to divest and to put in place a transparent process to ensure future investments by the CDPQ would not run into these basic violations of international law and international human rights law.
So, I'm sorry, when was that?
That was in May of 24.
May 24.
And so the selection committee had taken note of these two letters and decided that, well, he's not neutral. We can't hire him as a mediator. We need mediators to be neutral. And I was stunned. So after I picked up my jaw, I said, hold on. I didn't write these letters alone. I wrote them and co-signed them. I wrote them, but had them co-signed by six world-class experts in international law. And the fact that with these experts, I was calling on the CDPQ to respect international law has nothing to do with my capacity to be neutral as a sports mediator and a sports arbitrator. And therefore, I do not accept that this is a legitimate decision. That was the end of the conversation. And I thought about it and did a bit of research and realized that it was not only illegitimate, it was illegal. This was a violation of my right to equality in the exercise of my freedom of expression, as recognized by the Quebec Charter of Rights and Freedoms. So I wrote a complaint to the Quebec Commission of Rights and Freedoms, Commission des droits et libertés de la personne, and I didn't file it. I sent it to the DG of the Sport Dispute Resolution Center of Canada, and this would have been in March. And under cover of an email saying, look, I've thought about it. You recall, this is what you said. This is what I said when we had the debrief over the phone. I've come to the conclusion that this decision is not only illegitimate, but illegal. And here's why. Read the attached draft complaint. And I'm sending it to you in draft before filing it, both out of courtesy and because I hope that once you read it, you might come to your senses and realize that you're violating my freedom of expression and you didn't really mean to do that. And so let's fix this problem. Let's settle the dispute. So then several months went by. Well, oh, there's no response. And then, oh, we have to talk to our lawyer. And our lawyer made recommendations. So now we have to go to our board. So then I said, well, please give the following message from me to the board. I'm sure this was a good faith mistake, and you know, you didn't really intend to violate my right to equality in the exercise of my freedom of expression. So, you know, let's settle the matter. And then it took a long time to get a response from the board. And finally, on May 5th, the answer from the board was, no, we don't want to negotiate our decision to not renew your mandate as a mediator and not give you the mandate that you asked for as an arbitrator. So I thought about it some more, did some consultations, and filed my complaint last week. And I amended my draft complaint to reflect all of these subsequent exchanges to make clear that the violation of my right to equality in the exercise of my freedom of speech is in fact intentional. They do intend to prevent me from speaking freely, and they do intend to penalize me by removing my my employment with them. And so that justifies punitive damages under the Quebec Charter of Rights and Freedom. So it's just been filed. I haven't yet had a response from the commission, but I'll be following up with them shortly.
And all you did is you sent two letters to the CDPQ.
Had them published in Le Devoir. These were public letters. Yeah,
yeah, they're open letters.
Open letters published in Le Devoir. Yeah.
Signed by renowned international human rights lawyers across the world, I assume.
Yes, that's right.
The six of them.
Including three former special rapporteurs of the United Nations on the situation of human rights in the territory occupied by Israel since 1967.
Can you mention their names?
Oh, sure. So, well, Georges Abissab, as I mentioned earlier, was my Egyptian professor and friend. The three former UN special rapporteurs were Michael Link, Dick Falk, and John Dugard. And in addition, actually, there was another Quebecois who signed on, but he's not living in Quebec. He is Bill Chabas, and Bill kind of shuttles between Paris and London. He literally wrote the book on genocide. Mm-hmm. And he is responsible for the genocide part of the UN Audiovisual Library of International Law. So he's a world-renowned expert, not just in international law, but specifically on genocide.
Okay. And the request is the content of the open letter, two open letters, were about divestment or what specifically?
Yes, exactly. So there were two companies that were singled out in particular, because the case invests in dozens of companies which operate in the illegal Israeli settlements in the occupied Palestinian territory. But we drew attention in particular to two of them. One is WSP, an engineering firm based in Montreal that is responsible, that is the maître d'œuvre or coordinator of the Jerusalem light rail transit system, the purpose of which, of course, is to entrench illegally annexed East Jerusalem into the territory of Israel, right? Mm-hmm. And Alstom, which is a French company that bought Bombardier Rail and that is responsible for the Tel Aviv to Jerusalem rail link, which crosses into the occupied Palestinian territory and two parts of its rails, and basically is, you know, on illegally expropriated Palestinian land.
Okay. Two
and letters. thereby assisting in the illegal occupation of the Palestinian territory. And this is an important and recent international legal development, because when I published my two letters in November 23 and May 24, we did not yet have the benefit of the advisory opinion of the International Court of Justice that was rendered in July 24, which made clear that the Israeli occupation of Palestinian territory since 1967 is illegal, has no basis under international law. And the only legal thing that Israel can do in the occupied Palestinian territory is leave and pay compensation for all the damage done.
There's an excerpt from a new episode of Palestine Debrief. Find the show archives wherever you get your podcasts at cjpme.org and at harbingermedianetwork.com. You listen to Harbinger showcasing your local campus and community radio station. This episode is brought to you by the Alberta Advantage podcast and by Canadian progressive journalism community, unrig.ca.